We're glad you're checking out our teaching from the Truth and Love Conference at South Spring Baptist Church. Our desire for the Truth and Love Conference is to address the cultural issues of homosexuality and gender identity from a biblical perspective. So if you have questions about this topic or would like to know more, send us an email to info@southspring.org. That's info@southspring.org. We desire to equip you to live, teach, and tell the gospel, and we hope this teaching does just that. So enjoy and be encouraged.
Ready? Let's pray real quick. Father, we're so grateful for the good gift of your word. We're so grateful that you are God who loves us. And even though we are so broken and we are so frail, And Lord, if anything, the only inventiveness we seem to have is the ability to come up with new ways of expressing our brokenness. And Lord, as we continue to try to find how to love each other in our brokenness, I pray you will teach us how to do that well, and that we could stand by the truth while also completely integrating your grace and your love. Thank you, Father. We love you and we praise you and we ask these things in your Son's name for clarity today. Amen. All right, so as we look at these conversations, it has been funny to me. I've had numerous people say, like, "We're so glad you guys are hosting this at the church. We're so glad you're doing this," and then usually the follow up is, "Churches need to be doing this kind of stuff more." Just so you'll know, this is probably the third or fourth or fifth of these types of things that we've done just at this church, and other churches are doing it too, but people just don't watch or note it or schedule it or whatever. So it's just something to be aware of that they're out there, and if you're paying attention, then we get opportunities like this all the time. And then sometimes, obviously, in my other kind of career path, I do this some of these things as well. Okay, so jumping into the conversation today, what we're going to talk about, what we're focusing on mostly, is going to be the questions of gender and what issues of gender mean. And you're going to get my view. No one else should be blamed for my view, but it's going to be my view on how we play into these questions. And the first one has to do with sexuality. So anything that has to do with human sexuality, there are dozens of different headings with this topic. The Bible speaks directly to many of them, but not all of them. And this is creating part of our confusion is, one, it's hard enough when the Bible speaks clearly to something. It's even more difficult when the Bible doesn't mention certain things or doesn't speak directly to it. And we're stuck trying to figure out, okay, how do I apply this to this? And just about the time we start figuring something out, something new pops up, right? And so for us to be figuring this out, sexuality is a powerful topic. Obviously, sex plays a potent role in each of our lives. We quite literally, none of us would be here without it, right? And so this is an important conversation for us to be having. When God creates something powerful, like fire, he also creates boundaries for it. And there's going to be boundaries that are there that he puts in place. This is just like any other. I often, when I teach this to young people, I will often show a picture of Colonel Colt and talk about, hey, if this guy tells you don't point the cylindrical barrel part of this into your mouth and pull the trigger part of it, you need to listen to that because he's the guy who invented the revolver and he knows what he's talking about. When God created sexuality for human beings and for the other animals, but then specifically set apart human sexuality as something special, he also created boundaries around it. And we avoid those boundaries at our own risk. And human beings have enough freedom that we are given the freedom to avoid those boundaries, to ignore those boundaries. It's one of the things God allows us to do with anything powerful. By the way, that's not just sexuality, anything powerful like that. So when we engage in it and we look at it, know that we're going to be talking about theology and philosophy as a big deal. This is important. So is there a God who has an opinion? This is going to be our conversation that we dive into, and how would we possibly know it? But I want you to understand where we are and why we're where we are at this time in history, and it has to do with this concept of what people on the outside for a while now have been calling radical autonomy. People on the inside are now recently calling expressive individualism. Same concept, just different words. Expressive individualism says, it's a philosophical statement, and this is the perfect statement of it, like, is a philosophical statement that is based in postmodern thought. I can't unpack all of this. Come on in, it's okay. Which is based in postmodern thought. So I don't have time to unpack this. The 3-hour version of this, I unpack this quite a bit. But this version of it, the postmodern thought, tells us this. So pre-modern and modern both had the idea that there are external sources for things. External and internal. So in pre-modern, everything has an external source. Truth, knowledge, love, beauty, that's all determined by something outside of humanity. Whether it's God or fate or whatever. But there's something outside of humans that determines those things. In modern thought, there's a mixture. Some things come from the inside, some things come from the outside. There's a mixture. In postmodernism, it's important to understand that in postmodern thought, there are no outside sources. Everything comes from the inside. There is no external source for anything. If you understand this, you understand the root of where we are as a culture. We are a fully postmodern culture. And typically, the culture as a whole runs between 50 and 150 years behind the philosophers. The philosophers have already moved on from postmodernism for the most part. Postmodernism is an empty, self-refuting, dead-end philosophy. It's a metaphysic that won't work. But it's going to take another 100 to 150 years for the culture to realize what philosophers have already figured out. That's the good news. The bad news is the philosophers have no idea what comes next. Even modern philosophers now talking about future metaphysics have no clue what to replace this with. Now, as Christians, we would go, well, you could return to modernism, which actually is the best shot at probably a healthy mindset, a little bit of pre-modern with some modern. I was talking with someone the other day who's a philosopher, and he started laughing at me. He was like, you are so modern. Like, it's impossible for me to... He's like, everything you say, every word you use is a modern. I was like, I'm technically a Christian philosopher, which means I overlap a lot with modernism, and I love some things about postmodernism. We don't have time to talk about that, but... So here's the issue. The issue is, if there is no external source, that means the only source for anything about me is me. And there is no other source for that. And so whatever I declare to be true about me, therefore, is true. You can see how health and wealth teaching Christianity also has proceeded from postmodern thought. If I declare myself something, then it must be the case. It's a weird version of paganism. In this, if I say I am an Asian, then no one gets to tell me I'm not in postmodern thought. No one can tell me I'm not an Asian. I've said I am. There is no external source. And by the way, one of the weirdest aspects of modern postmodernism, current postmodernism, is that genetics are considered an external source. I don't exactly know how that leap was made, but at some point it was made. Genetics are considered external of me. And so that there's an external source, genetics is one of them. If I say I'm Asian, now, if I say I'm Asian, and I decide to live as though I'm Asian, and I make decisions as though I'm Asian, what I would say to you, if you go like, well, you're not, but you're not Asian, I would say, one, why would you bother to fight with me about that, right? I mean, I'm not hurting you. I'm just saying I'm Asian. How does that possibly hurt you? That doesn't damage you. That doesn't mess with society. It's just my choices. It's my body. It's my mind. It's my choices. I just decide this, and who are you to tell me otherwise? Plus, postmodern thought says, you are actually being offensive by trying to tell me something about me. There are no external sources, and you certainly aren't one of them. Like, you aren't one of those who gets to speak to me. The issue is, there's a line, though, that the step doesn't end with, I am Asian. If we're all going to agree, and this is how this happened, if we're all going to agree that I'm Asian, and you've probably seen videos where they talk about this on college campuses, where people walk around and ask, if I say I'm Asian, how do you feel about that? And everyone goes, I mean, hey, that's just you, right? and so if I say that, here's the issue is, if I am this thing, then it is illogical to not let me do the things that are connected to that thing. So, for example, are Asian people allowed to fill out scholarships for Asian people? Yes, right? That's what they're for. We all agreed I'm Asian. Therefore, I can fill out scholarship forms for Asian people. See, how do you tell me that I can't fill out the form for the Asian people? There's only one way. What do you got to do? Tell me that I'm not Asian. Because if we agree that I am Asian, then it makes no sense that I can't fill out the form for the Asian people. Like, that makes no sense. So there's a consequence. This is how this works. Makes sense? Are you following me? Okay, so what if I say I'm 7 feet tall? Should you be required to engage with me as though... Because that's what expressive means. I express it outward, and you're supposed to agree with my expression. If you refuse to agree with my expression, then what you've done is you've now oppressed me. That's what oppressed means. That's why they use the word expressive. So the opposite of expressive in the postmodern thought is oppression. Now, that doesn't make any sense, but that's the argument that's made. So if I say I'm 7 feet tall, when you talk to me, should you have to look above my head? Because I've declared it. Am I allowed to be offended if you keep looking me in the eyes as though I'm only 6 feet tall? That one's a tough one. Let's do another one. What if I say I am a woman? So if we agree that I'm a woman, now you can see the crisis that's instantly created, because it turns out it isn't harmless for me to decide I'm a woman and for everyone to agree with that. It would be if it was standalone. If I was a hermit on an island, no one would care if I declared myself a woman. But in a culture, when you declare yourself a woman, remember, if I am this thing, I should be able to do the things that this thing does. And so are women allowed into women's locker rooms? Yes, absolutely. Of course, that's why they're called women's locker rooms. They exist for that purpose. Are women allowed to go to women's shelters?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. Are women allowed to compete with other women in women's sports? Yes. So if I say I am a woman, it is then illogical and oppressive. You would never tell a woman she can't compete in women's sports. Like, that's just nuts. Like, you deserve to be thrown in prison if you're a school that won't let women compete in women's sports, right? So can women compete in women's sports? Yes, that's why women's sports exist. Then what is the only option for keeping me from competing in women's sports? Deny that I'm a woman, which is oppressive. And so to deny I'm a woman is oppressive on your part. That's oppressive for you to say that I'm not a woman, because no one gets to tell me about anything about me except me. I decide it, therefore I am this. Again, if that were harmless, that might be theologically damaging, but it's not harmless on society. Because if we all agree I'm a woman, then I should get to do the things women do. And if I'm not allowed to do the things that women do, then the only argument you have is that I'm not actually a woman. You see how that works? Okay, and if you're not willing to say that, you're hosed, right? I now get to dictate terms. I can do all the things women do. What if I say I'm 7 years old? Are second graders allowed to have second grade boyfriends and girlfriends?
Sure,
why not? Well, I'm 7, so I should be able to have a 7-year-old girlfriend, shouldn't I? Because we let 7-year-old girl have 7-year-old girlfriends. 7-year-old boys are allowed to have 7-year-old girlfriends. So if I'm 7 and we all agree that I'm 7, we're all okay with that, then I should be able to have a 7-year-old girlfriend. And if you tell me I can't, then you're being oppressive against me. It isn't harmless, it turns out. It isn't harmless on a culture to deny basic things. Now, part of this, and we'll get here when we're wrapping up, is the other part of this issue is that psychologically, and atop theologically and philosophically, psychologically, by the way, and you can see why this whole movement has to deny anything that has to do with, for example, Christianity or Islam or Judaism, because all three of those say that there is an external source, and that the external source has a higher authority than I do, even over me. And especially in evangelical Christianity, or fundamentalist Islam, or traditional Judaism, all three teach that my opinions are submitted to God's opinions. My preferences are inferior. It's all based on the premise that humans aren't trustworthy, which, by the way, is absolutely provable. It has been proven over every time. The psychologists in the room, you've probably seen studies like this where they will literally, if you've ever had a fight with your spouse, and the fight is basically, I said or did this, and the other person says, no, you didn't, you said or did this, right? So when we run tests on people's ability to remember what they said or did, what do we discover? No one knows. Both of you are wrong. You are both going to end up being wrong on it. What's wild is that we're so bad, and by the way, all of us delusionally think of our own brains as a tape recorder. We think of ourselves as taking outside information, and we hold it flawlessly. And we can actually show that when you ask someone, what did you say in the fight, the part of the brain that's triggered is the creative part of the brain, not the memory part of the brain. And so we are creating the history when we describe it, because we remember ourselves saying and doing what we wish we had said or done. And we don't remember what we actually... You can test this in that you can record somebody and just several hours later ask them what they said, and they will be absolutely sure, and they'll be wrong. And people, we're so delusional as humans, people will say, this is some kind of trick, you changed the recording. We're that sure of ourselves. So not only are we wrong, but we are delusionally wrong. Anytime Ginger and I get in a conflict and it's about you said this and I said this, I'm like, let's start over. What do you wish you had said? Tell me that. And when you're done, I'll go like, oh, that would have been great. Okay, we don't have a conflict. Or can I tell you what I wish I had said? Well, I think I said this, but I know I may not have. Here's what I wish I had said. If I had said that, would we be good? Yes. Then can we be good? That's what I thought I said. Anyway, it saves a lot of time. So what are some external sources that would maybe be more trustworthy? We're going to get to this idea of delusion and why we're not actually helping people when we help them in their delusion. So I'm going to talk about that before we're done. So one possible source would be genetics. A possible source to tell us something about ourselves would be genetics. I should be able to look at my genetics to know whether I'm Asian or not. That would be a good thing to do. It's a pretty simple, solid concept. In regards to sex, I do think that as Christians, one of the things the Bible has spoken clearly to that we need to maintain a stand on is there are two sexes. This is a binary, and it's a true binary. There are only two options. There's these two. And this is important to understand. And it is determined by genetics. Again, we can invent other things, but we need to hold on to the fact that there's such a thing as this. Not only because of genetics. So for example, what you will hear very quickly if you point this out in the LGBTQ movement is they will start talking about intersex or DSD, the difference of sexual development is an issue. This is when intersex or DSD is when an individual is born with any of several variations in their sexual characteristics, any number of different things, okay? They, quote, do not fit the typical definitions of male or female bodies. That does happen. There are babies who are born who do not fit perfectly. Now, it's extremely rare, and of the ones that even happen, which it's about 1 in 1,000 births. So about 1 in 1,000 births, there's something genetically off enough about their genitals that eventually some type of treatment will have to happen. Usually it's not right then. Sometimes it's right then. Sometimes it's later. Anything, though, counts there. Anything, and I won't go into detail about what those could be, but some are clearly extremely minor. There's no question about whether they're XX or XY. It just has to do with the presentation, and a simple thing fixes that. And that's common. There are what are called true hermaphrodites, people who present with both sex organs, at least to some degree. This is fantastically rare. It's about 1 in every 85,000 births. So it's super rare. It is much more rare than flipping a coin and having the coin land on the edge, okay? And so if you said, well, we should have this, and by the way, no one is claiming that hermaphrodite should be a lifestyle choice. No one's arguing that. No hermaphrodite would want to stay a hermaphrodite. No one does that. No one, and what's funny is they go to this very quickly, the argument will go to this very quickly in order to show, see, there's not just two options. They go there very quickly, but the truth is there are still two options. To say there are times when there's a genetic defect does not change the number of options. That doesn't change the number of choices that are there. What it means is sometimes there's a breakdown in what happens. And so when you say a true hermaphrodite, by the way, the vast majority of intersex are XXY. And they're really, really, again, super rare. 1 in 1,000 is not even, 1 in 1,000 is some change needs to happen. It's somewhat more than that for something that would be called intersex. Intersex one in, so what that shows you is, sorry, XXY. The majority of people who are intersex XXY, almost all of them present male, and clearly enough male that no one ever checks their genetics. And so the truth is we have to go back to discover what the numbers are because most of these people live their life as a male because they have X and Y, and the X and Y is dominant over 2X if you have all three of them. So they present as male, and they live as male their whole lives. The true hermaphrodites, the 1 in 85,000, are the ones who you would be more concerned about. A good thing to keep in mind, 4 million babies are born every year in the U.S. 40,000 of them have a heart defect. Is that a lifestyle? Do you go, oh, see, that's proof that humans don't need hearts. It's not heart yes or heart no. You could also have heart maybe, right? Because 40,000 of them are born with an incomplete heart. So that shows that there's a third option. It's that humans can have a non-heart. No one does that. And incidentally, intersex has nothing to do with the LGBTQ movement. It is thrown out as a statistic to show there are other options. This is not who becomes gender dysphoria. None of that happens from that's not where this comes from. Only 4,000, so 40,000 a year have heart defects. Only 4,000 a year have any kind of genital defect at all. This is not a thing that we need to be spending a lot of time camping on beyond saying, how do we treat them? How do we help, medically? How do we medically treat them? How do we help them? To go, listen, this kid is born with a defect. We need to leave it alone because this is going to be a lifestyle choice for them. No. What they need is medical treatment. They need it right then. We'll talk more about that before we're done. So medical treatment will be a bigger part of the conversation. So genetics is one way to begin to engage with this conversation. And the other one is revelation, especially for us as Christians. We are stuck with the fact that God delineated two sexes. There's no question that he did. Let us make man in our image, verse 26 of Genesis 1. Verse 27, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. The word created, 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 created. This was the design. This was the purpose. And this is somehow connected to even the image conversation. Now, image, I think there's a lot of teaching about image, most of which I think is bad. I think Jesus interprets the word image for us very clearly in the New Testament. Image means ownership. Image means possession. God owns us in the same way that Caesar owns his coins. Why does that coin go to Caesar? Because it's Caesar's. How do you know it's Caesar's? Because it bears his image. When Jesus is teaching on image, a good Jewish audience immediately would go to this passage. As Christians, we don't. We think it's about something else. We think it's about taxation. Because Jesus then says, and give to God what is God's. So he's clearly referencing image. How do you know what's image? We bear his image. Well, we go to God. How do you know we're God's? Because we bear his image. That's the question. And I think that's the main teaching on this. And this is very good teaching according to Jesus, according to God in Genesis. When Jesus comes back and looks at it, I think he totally backs and emphasizes this idea. Image is about God gets to say. And what God has said is male and female. Can you imagine if God had put anything else as important as that in an important passage as this? I mean, this is letter one. I mean, this is it right at the beginning. And we skim over it because we're all used to it. But imagine if he had put skin color in here. Then there would be all kinds of weirdness that would come with that, right? And by the way, image has nothing to do with any physical representation in and of itself. It has to do with who we are internally, who we are, that we are his. But when he dictated how we would be, he dictated sex, male and female. Okay. So moving into then the question of gender, then what is gender? If that's sex, if sex is male and female, the gender is an expression from masculine to feminine. Now, I'm going to disagree in just a second with many other pastors and even people in my field in one aspect of this. I'll explain. I believe, for example, that what you have with feminine and masculine is we have scriptural guidance about some of this, but we don't have clear scriptural teaching on what gender is. It's just not there. There's nothing in the Bible that says this is what men are supposed to act like as different from how what women are supposed to act like. Okay? There are role differences, which I'll get to in a second. That's the emphasis Scripture takes, is role differences. So when you go, men are supposed to act like, are supposed to be courageous, right? And women aren't? You would never say that. What we have are character traits that go with being a God follower, a God fearer, a Christ follower. Like, there are character traits that come with being a disciple. But we don't see any that are said, these are good for men and these are bad, but the same one is bad for a woman or vice versa. Now, we could delineate culturally which ones, I don't want to get ahead of that, but we could try to do that. Let's talk about what gender is first. I'm going to get there first. Gender is a result of clothing. If there were no clothes, because gender's whole purpose, they are socio-cultural constructs meant to communicate the biological sex of the individual without needing to verify the biological sex. Okay? In other words, it is culture by culture different. There is no clear teaching on Scripture what should count. Should you wear dresses or should you wear pants for men? That's not taught scripturally. It's not given the specifics this and this and this. You might argue hair length. That's at least an hour long conversation. But we wouldn't have a chance to get into. But the pattern seems to be, the biblical pattern seems to be, that we are supposed to communicate our sex with our gender expression. And so you'll know that's its purpose. Notice, that's its purpose. In other words, I should be able to tell If I know the culture, I should be able to tell whether you are male or female without looking up your skirt, right? I should be able to tell without having to see your genitals, because that's what gender is. And it's vitally important. Every society demands it. Every society has always demanded it. It is vitally important that I know which roles you're playing. I have to know that. If I don't know that, I will treat you incorrectly. So if I don't know if you're male or female, I need to know that. And I shouldn't have to get up every time and wear a name tag or declare my pronouns in order to... It is so important that we know that we literally, as a culture, are trying to reject it. And in rejecting it, what we have is people stand up and speak their pronouns. Or you could just dress according to the proper sex. That would also tell us which one you are. And by the way, the vast majority of them do. They still do. We demand this. This is also not harmless. Gender is necessary for a sane culture. What we're running into, those of you in the medical world know, and especially in emergency rooms, is we're running into a major issue of men who come in, they fill out their form, they check the box men, they have abdominal pain, and the doctor begins to treat them, and what happens? It turns out they're pregnant. And the doctor kills the baby in the process of trying to treat the man for his abdominal pain, because they didn't know that this was actually a woman. This is an XX chromosome human being. And so it's important that we know which sex you are. And culture needs to know that. If the police are chasing you and they're about to tackle you, they need to know whether you are male or female, because they're going to tackle a male differently than they tackle a female. And if they think you're a male when you're really a female, they're probably going to break bones. That's something we need to know. There's so many different examples of where this plays out. Do I need to step in and protect you, or do I need to let you face whatever this crisis is on your own? And some of that's going to be case by case. If it's two men in conflict, I'm less likely to step in. If I knew one of them was actually a female, it was in danger of being raped, I would probably step in. But I can't tell. I can't, and I don't have time to ask, what are your personal pronouns? And by the way, I need to know what your actual sex is, because that's what's going to dictate this. A sane culture has this. And so this is all that gender is. So here's what I would tell you. I do not believe sex and gender are interchangeable words. Now, there are people other pastors and teachers who would disagree with that. I don't think they're interchangeable words. I think if one doesn't point to the other, it serves no purpose. The purpose of gender is to tell me which sex you are. That's its purpose. If it doesn't, then it serves no value whatsoever in culture. It's meaningless in culture. I don't know that it will ever go away. This is one of my favorite memes about this, by the way. So it has a picture of Barbie. Sorry if those of you can't see. This is Barbie. Throughout the years, she's been the center of much controversy because feminists claim she represents an unrealistic, unhealthy, and unfair standard of beauty, leading to a crisis for young girls and their self-esteem. And this is He-Man. Uh-oh, looks like my computer's starting to run low. Because the truth is, of course, there's going to be badly... Anytime the world creates something, which we shouldn't be surprised by any of this... You'll see a plug. Is it under the table? All right. Because this is a man-made thing. Now, I don't know that it's man-invented. God may have put that in place. But Adam and Eve were naked. They didn't need gender. And even afterwards, if you believe they were the only two humans on the planet, they still didn't need it, because Adam knew which one he was, and he knew which one that meant Eve was, right? So you wouldn't need a hermit on an island. Their gender would be meaningless, which, by the way, would quickly happen. They would quickly stop caring about how masculine or feminine they presented. It wouldn't make any difference. And the same thing is true in small cultures, in families. It doesn't matter when you're at home with just your family, which gender you probably dress, the husband and wife probably dress a lot alike sometimes when they're just sitting around at home watching TV. Because it doesn't matter what you're presenting. They already know which sex you are. It's a cultural kindness to have gender. It is sane to have gender. Now, you're going to run into immediately the question of, well, what about little kids who who practice the other gender, who express that, who go, I'm a little boy, but I like dressing like a little girl. I'm a little girl. They say that. Or I'm a little girl, and I like dressing like a little boy, or I'm a little boy. Now, I want you to imagine, listen to this. This is from 2017 in National Geographic. See if you can imagine this being published today, just 4 years later. If a boy is doing things that are girl-like, He wants long hair. He wants to try on his mother's shoes. He wants to wear a dress and play with dolls. Then he's saying to himself, I'm doing girl things, therefore I must be a girl. But understand, when a little child says that, it means I am a little girl in the same way that I am an astronaut, I am a monkey, I am a fire truck. Okay? I'm doing fire truck things. I'm running through the house screaming siren noises. And when you ask them, why are you screaming siren noises, what do they say? I'm a fire truck. Why are you down on your hands and knees making cat noises? Because I'm a cat. See, a child doesn't understand. They link those things naturally. They're learning about the world around them. And what they need is guidance in that situation, not acceptance of their delusional, childlike version of reality. And so here's what. Can you imagine this phrase? This is what the expert quoted by National Geographic in just 2017 said. These preferences or imaginations are gender expression, not gender identity. He said he'd like to see parents take a step back and remind the boy, quote, that he can do all sorts of things that girls do. That doesn't mean he's a girl. That you can do all sorts of things that a cat can do. That doesn't mean you're a cat. You can do all sorts of things that a fire truck can do. That doesn't mean you're a fire truck. Children need that clarification. Of course you can wear a dress like a girl can. That doesn't mean you're a girl, right? And by the way, they all do. They all do all of these, especially if they've got an older sibling of the opposite sex or they're more connected to the opposite sex parent. That's all very normal to do that. There's nothing weird about it. Parents don't need to weird out in one direction, nor do they need to weird out in the opposite direction. They don't need to go, oh, my little boy is actually a little girl. This is a gender identity. No, he's 3 or 4 or 5. And up until then, he doesn't even have an understanding of reality versus non-reality. Children at that age don't know that there's not actually a cucumber and a tomato sitting somewhere singing about veggie Bible stories. They think that actually exists somewhere. Think about how little children understand below puberty about what all of this conversation is about. Do they understand what that means? I mean, could my adopted son Michael at age 10, could he delineate the different what it means that he's adopted and Holland isn't? Would he go, oh, well, it has to do with my dad's sperm and my mom's eggs? No, he has no idea what any of that means. I use the example of Holland. He doesn't remember this, but he was 4 or 5 years old, and that Ginger was going somewhere with him and his older siblings, and Holland said, where's the other kid? And she's like, what do you mean the other kid? And he's like, you know, the big one. He meant me. And so the reason he thought I was in charge was because I was big, not because I was dad. Dad, what does that even mean? That's just a title or a name that a little kid's not going to understand at all, right? So that's understanding. When we assign meaning to that, we're not helping them. When we put too much into that, so we learn to say, yeah, you can do all kinds of things that a girl would do. That doesn't make you a girl. You're still a boy. And we have that, and so we don't react one way or the other in negative ways, and we help them delineate that. And what we've learned is that the majority of children who at some point begin to declare themselves the other sex, that will go away. Almost all of them do at some point, but then even the ones who seem more declarative about it, the vast majority, that changes back at some point. And so that's why you've got more and more medical professionals stepping up saying, this gender blocking stuff has got to end. It is child abuse. We'll get there. I got to hurry to get there. So what we look at is this is what gets added in is the center area that just recently got added in. But I want you to notice that's just crazy. It's exactly the same thing I had drawn. Masculine, feminine. It's still the same. It's a continuum. And of course it changes day to day and moment to moment. Some of you look more or less feminine or more or less masculine. Right? I mean, Anna's wearing a cap today, right? That's kind of masculine. That doesn't mean she's masculine. If I said, hey, we're doing this event, I need you to come looking as feminine as possible, she probably wouldn't wear a cap, right? Because you all know what that would mean if I said that. There's nothing wrong with that. Of course that's the case. Very few of you are dressed up, and some of you aren't wearing makeup or whatever. But if I said, okay, we've got this event, and this is a special event, and the guys are becoming looking as masculine as they can, and the women are going to look as feminine as they can, I wouldn't have to tell you what that meant. You would know what to do with that because culturally we know. There's nothing wrong with this. It's the same thing. Just because you're dressed like a man doesn't make you a man. Just because you're dressed like a woman doesn't make you a woman. That's not how that... See, that's dictated by X and Y chromosomes, not by your clothing or your presentation. Okay, so we'll get to more about that in a second. But I just make sure we understand, this is still a continuum. This is not a spectrum. It's crazy this is called a spectrum. That's not a spectrum. Sorry. I got so disappointed when Facebook came out with 51 different gender choices, and I went and looked, and they're all the same thing. They're all just a continuum, and they're just giving names to things. I deny the whole continuum. Half of them were just going, there is no continuum. Like, I mean, you can say that. It doesn't change anything to declare that. But so, for example, my favorite example is to show you, understand, I want to make sure this is clear. Normally, we would say skirts are an indication of what? Feminine, right? So if you're wearing a skirt, that probably means you're female. But culturally, that may not be the case. No one would go, feminine, right? I mean, that is twisted steel and sex appeal right there, right? That is as masculine as you can get, but he's wearing a skirt. Just because you're wearing a skirt doesn't make you a woman. Dresses, the same thing, right? This is a culture absolutely dedicated to the delineation between male and female. To the point of execution, delineating male and female, right? But they're wearing dresses and headscarves. And yet you wouldn't ever confuse, because in that culture, this communicated clearly. Gender is a set of cultural norms meant to communicate, which one am I? Am I male or am I female? And that's what the whole thing is about. Now, did that get dark?
Yes.
Who knows? Okay. It's just periodic. Maybe it'll come back. Okay, so that is different. And by the way, I think the biblical teaching is not, since it isn't, hey, here's what you're supposed to be, here's what you're supposed to do. And when we look through the Bible and even look for anything that's like biblical masculinity as differentiated from biblical femininity. Now listen, biblical male, there are roles only men can have in the Bible. They include things like father, son, brother, husband. And women are never allowed to be one of those four things. Those are roles that only men are allowed to have. Women have roles that only women... And by the way, there's lots of teaching to those four roles. Listen, if you're this, you act like these. You do this and this and this. Same thing is true. Mother, daughter, sister, wife. And those are taught very clearly. How to behave according to those ways. What's interesting is the character traits that are sometimes used. So a woman is supposed to be respectful to her husband. That's what's hard about being a wife, right? To be respectful to your husband. Are husbands not supposed to be respectful to their wives? No, of course we are. That's totally appropriate. But it may look different in those roles. How does that look within the roles? The roles are what the Bible focuses its attention on, which makes sense given that, for example, gender is cultural. So you don't have a biblical passage that says boys don't wear skirts. You don't have that. Why not? Because masculinity and femininity is important for its role in the community. And that's what you see over and over again. When you see the Bible commanding, for example, in Deuteronomy, that a man should not wear women's clothing or a woman wear man's clothing, it doesn't say what the clothing is. It doesn't say that. Why? Because the purpose is a sane, kind society. In order to be sane and kind, which is, you need to make sure people know which sex you are. And whatever that looks like in your culture, that's what I believe is being called for. That is very different from this. From intentionally saying, I'm this. From someone who is a male, and again, I don't know what his genital situation is. I'm not interested. It is important that we know in a culture that if you say, I am female, though I am male, then we have a different problem. And at that point, the problem becomes an issue of mental instability, of mental issues. That's not what's going on here. He's not trying to convince you that he's a female, nor are they. Not trying to convince female. That would be different. And this is why it's okay, for example, for a man to dress up as a woman and present as a woman in a play, for example. Because he's not actually trying to convince you he's a female. He's dressed up as a female for the purpose of a skit or a play. This is part of why the church did not go crazy about transgender, drag queen type of thing, is because the issue with them had to do with sexuality and sexual, profligism or whatever the word, the profligate mindset about sexuality. The sexuality doesn't matter because in the beginning, they weren't pretending to be female. That was the whole joke was, I am a male, I'm just pretending to be female because that's funny. And so that's why there was not a huge deal like, Okay, that's not the problem with this. You're not trying to convince us you're female. I mean, the beard gives it away, right? And so you're not trying to convince us you're female. You're just acting female because that's funny. That's why we don't throw Dustin Hoffman as Tootsie. You don't go like, oh, that's a sin. Like, no, no, it's what it is funny. And so we do that. That's one thing. That's a whole other heading on how humor changes our ethics, but that's a different conversation. So remembering the purpose of gender, to know what sex you are without checking, the biblical passages make sense to guide towards a sane culture. Now we're going to dive into this part of it, which is interesting. This is the deal. This is where we are as professionals right now, and I know you are as parents and grandparents as well. And the problem is this has all changed so quickly, it's hard for us to know. But dysmorphia and dysphoria, the question that I ask as a professional is, when someone is brought to me and says, I was born a male, I've decided I am female, is that I say, what kind of problem is this? That's what I've got to know. If I'm going to treat someone, I need to know what kind of problem it is. So is this a big medical problem? So let me ask, is it morally wrong for a woman to have her breast surgically removed? No. We do it all the time for breast cancer, right? Someone comes in and they are very sick. I mean, they could die if we don't do this. Then no Christians go like, no, none of that transgender stuff, right? We don't do that. If a woman's got breast cancer, we go, yeah, do what you need to do medically to treat that, right? If a man has testicular cancer and they have to remove his testicles, we don't go, whoa, none of that, because we know this is a severe medical issue. And the rules kind of change when it's severe medical issues. Does this make sense? Mm-hmm. So when a mom comes in and when a family comes in and says, this child was born male but has now decided he is female, I go, okay. Or if I'm speaking publicly, if I go, like, okay, this is a big issue then. Like, this child is very, very sick. Like, so sick we would consider removing organs from them. Is that what you're telling me? That they are that ill? And they would say, what? No, he's not ill. There's no illness here. There's nothing wrong here. He's just decided he's a girl. And I would go, so this is just cosmetic surgery then. Like, that's all you're asking for is cosmetic. This is like a breast augmentation. This is someone who looks and is like, I don't like how they look. I'm going to get surgery to fix it. So this is not a big deal at all. This is just a personal preference. That's all that it is. And what do they say? No. This is a serious issue. This can't be something that you just treat like that. You can't be flippant about this. This is a serious, this is very real and very serious. And I go, oh, okay, so this is like breast cancer. No. So the problem is, as a professional that we're running into right now, is we don't have any treatment options for things that aren't one of those two things. So the question is this a serious illness that needs treatment? Is this dysmorphia? Dysmorphia that you would go, wow, this is serious. She's going to die if something doesn't change. We got to jump on this. We got to hospitalize her. We got to get her all the help we can get because she is very, very sick. And so this is the equivalent of breast cancer in the psychological world. This is a huge problem. Well, the problem is we've learned over the years that helping someone engage in their dysmorphia does not actually help them. We actually know, I mean, the evidence of that is very clear. People who need to spend their life carving on their body because they have some kind of obsessive disorder to change things, it is not helping them to help them do that. We know that. As in the therapeutic world, we never align with someone's delusions. That is never healthy. So if someone comes in who's schizophrenic and they're like, I have aliens beaming thoughts in my head, I don't ask them the next week they come up. When next time they come in, I go like, well, how are the aliens this week? Right? Because that would be unkind. That is bad treatment. So you don't do that. You don't tell Michael, what's with the TV? You don't tell Michael, I'm afraid to touch anything because it's going to, let's see, is it? Oh, well, I don't know what the deal is. The screen's not, oh, well, okay. It doesn't know it's being used, I guess. Okay, so the issue here is, it's not, is it serious like this? Or maybe the most modern version of it is the screen version of this. We now have people who more and more, we're having people who live at home and who don't ever come out. They only present themselves digitally so that they can change their physical appearance just enough to communicate, this is who I am. These are all considered dysmorphia. Well, I don't know if this one would be or not anymore. A few years ago, a new word was invented, dysphoria. This is a brand new word in the psychological world. It means dysmorphia, except it's not a disorder. It has absolutely no difference in meaning. Its only meaning is to say it's exactly the same thing as dysmorphia. It's just not a disorder. This is absolute insanity on the part of the American Psychological and Physicians Association that they just created a new word that says what we used to call dysmorphia is now a lifestyle. And all that matters is, are they happy with it or not happy with it? And so literally there was an article written saying, this is depression, this is serial killers. Like, this is serious, we got to deal with this. This is a big deal, we've got to jump all over this. And who gets to decide whether you have dysmorphia or dysphoria? You want to make a guess? You do. You get to decide. And the medical world is supposed to treat you based on what you say. So the treatment for dysphoria is to engage in the delusion and help you with the delusion. This is madness, by the way, in the medical world. It can't last. There's no way this can last. But in other words, we need to figure out how to help her stay in her house and never have to come out again so she can present herself the way she wants. We need to help her. Now, no one's going to say this, by the way. Anorexia is where that you're not allowed to talk about this publicly. If I did this in a professional sphere somewhere outside of Texas, I would probably be removed from the building to talk about this. In the psychological world, the KCREP accreditation would hand me kicked out in a heartbeat, because you're not allowed to ask it. You're not allowed to align these and ask these questions. You just don't talk about it. People who do, they don't get published. So this is, but as Christians, how do we do it? What do we believe about this? What do we believe when someone looks in a mirror who's a male but he sees a female? What do we believe about that? How do we help them? And I think in order to love them well, we recognize if they have an obsessive disorder, we don't help them in their obsession. If they have some type of dysmorphia or dysphoria, what we have to learn to do is to love them in the midst of it and seek to maintain that conversation. And part of it is also to recognize it's important that we help people understand in the Christian world to help them understand suffering is not always bad. And so being uncomfortable is not always bad. Not getting what I want is not bad. We don't have time for it today, but you could study the process by which the word harm has the definition of the word harm has changed. Most of our legal documents refer to harm. Many of our legal documents do, which was always the problem. Is it wasn't clearly defined at the beginning because everyone knew exactly what was meant by that. It was the difference between hurt and harm. Hurt is momentary. Harm is lifelong. And so what was decided was, at some point decided, is that if you hurt my feelings, that has now done harm to me. And so because the word harm now means all of that, anything that gets to declare, and by the way, who do you think gets to decide whether or not you were harmed? You do. So what happens is you have someone who says, I have been oppressed, and that has created lifelong harm to me, and there are laws that protect me from harm. And so they didn't change the law, they changed the meaning of the word harm. And so the problem is, as a professional, oh look, it came back on, looks like magic. As a professional, I would say helping him do this is harm. But I'm an external source. If he says it's harm not to let him do it, we have a problem. If I say this is harm and she says it's harm to not let me do it, we have a problem. The external source is never going to trump the internal source anymore. And so she gets to decide that. We're not going to, don't have time for the gingerbread man or the gender unicorn. I want you to, like, actually, we don't have time for the rest of that stuff. So I want to make sure you've got a chance to ask a couple of questions, but I want to say, I think as Christians, I do think one thing is that we need to stand on is the idea of that there are only two sexes. And I think we need that anchor for the entire rest of the conversation. It's what nature teaches us. It's what the Bible teaches us. There are only two sexes. It's wild to consider that we'd have to have that conversation. That's not been open to debate. There are only two options. Then the question is, well, what if I am one, but I feel like the other one? And I think, generally speaking, what we want to do is we talk with somebody and love somebody who's facing that. And I know almost all of us now know someone directly or indirectly who is dealing with this. Is that what we have to figure out how to do, and by the way, none of us know, so do all this with grace, because none of us know. I just said a second ago, so if someone comes to me and goes, well, do you think if my daughter has decided she is a man, should we have surgery for her? And my answer is, there's no research. And if there is research, you're not allowed to publish about it. What we know from this is, this doesn't cure their anxiety. It doesn't have an effect on it. They may feel better for a few seconds after surgery, and then they begin obsessing over the next one. I guarantee you her staying at home is not helping her. Letting her not eat is not helping her. So the question is, how do you love someone in the midst of when someone is doing that? Well, if they have breast cancer, if we say, listen, it turns out when you reassign their gender and you do the surgery and you do the hormones, they're cured. Like all of a sudden they're fine. They're totally fine. Like that cures them. I need the research for that in order to be able to even think about defending that. Because I don't know that it's wrong to do that. The Bible doesn't say it's wrong to actually totally change all this. I suspect what we will learn is it doesn't work in the same way that God has said there's male and female and you need to learn to live according to the one you are, even if you have a delusion that you're the other one. I suspect that it's no different than these, that engaging in the delusion doesn't help. What little research we have indicates it doesn't really help. It just seems to not. Now, again, is that because of the culture? Is it because of, you know, ancient backwards thinkers like me? Is that why it's not seeming to help? Well, I guess we'll see, because it's not like it's not going to happen. But the problem is, if the research doesn't back that viewpoint, that it's good for them to make this change, it's not going to be published. So I don't know how to find this out. But the earliest research for people who started doing sex reassignment surgery, now they're calling that sex alignment surgery, that's one of the things you can always, when they're changing the words constantly, that's one of the ways you know they're covering something. It's like, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, right? No, nothing going on back there. I always am suspicious when they start changing words. That's like the movie that's coming out and they advertise it too much. And you're like, yeah, they know this stinks. They're trying to get us, we got to come weekend one or no one's coming, right? Something smells in Denmark, right? There's something about that. I suspect that's the case. Even as a Christian, even as a pastor, even as someone who absolutely believes there is male and female only and that that's taught scripturally, as a professional, I'm willing to say, listen, if you can show me that in the same way that breast cancer is treated by removing the breast sometimes, if you can show me that the proper medical treatment for this is surgery, I'm willing to listen. But I need that. I can't just say, no, this is the same thing. In the same way that we wouldn't kick someone out of our church and call it sin if someone gets, you know, surgery to fix the bags under their eyes. We wouldn't go like, nope, see, you're trying to reassign something. God made you have bags under your eyes, so you need to accept that. So we wouldn't necessarily say that, right? And if we're not willing to say that there, then we don't need to automatically say it over here. Again, I suspect it's no more healthy here than it is to get the bags under your eyes actually fixed. Doesn't actually fix anything for you, turns out. But I'm willing to have that conversation if there is evidence to support that that's the actual medical treatment. But if it's dysmorphia, I can tell you right now, it won't help. That'll be one of the ways we know, because dysmorphia is not helped by engaging in, delusions are not helped by engaging in the delusion. So what do we do when we have a child or a grandchild or a friend or a student who does this? Here's where we are right now, I think. This will change. I am confident. But what we're trying to do at this stage is respond, one, frantically, obviously, but you heard Beckett say, pray and love seem to be the two patterns that are there. I love what he said when he said, I already know what my sister believes. She doesn't need to keep telling me over and over again. And so I do think sometimes there's a first conversation. Just want to make sure that we're totally clear. I suspect you know everything I'm about to say. But let me just tell you, it's never my job to help you screw up your life. And I think you are choosing something that is unhealthy, sinful, and ungodly, and I'm not willing to help you do that because that would be wrong of me. It would be wrong for me to help you in your meth addiction. And I think this is equivalent. I think you're messing up your life. As your parent, as your friend, it's never my job to help you destroy your life. And I think you're destroying your life. Now, that being said, it's also not my job to constantly berate you about destroying your life. What I'm here to do is help you when and if you decide that that's true. That you go, this isn't good for me. So that you have a sister like Beckett's sister, who you can imagine when he said, God has radically saved me, I'm taking a new direction, I'll bet she would have moved heaven and earth to come alongside him, right? Where she was willing to have coffee with him every once in a while and talk about other things in the meantime. So the question I get all the time with this automatically is names and pronouns. And that comes down to this conversation, I think. Again, 6 weeks from now, I may change my mind on this. But the only way we can do it right now ethically as Christians, I think, is to ask the question, what would I do if it was something different? Here's what I mean. So if Holland decided that he was going to go by the name Moonbeam from now on, okay? And I was like, he was like, I want you to call me Moonbeam from now on. I would go, well, that's weird. We would have a conversation about it. But if he's like, I just think Moonbeams are awesome and I want to be called Moonbeam, I would go, all right, we'll go with Moonbeam. There's no moral or ethical reason not to, right? He changed his name. He gets to change his name. I think it's weird and strange, but fine. We'll call him Moonbeam. But if he said, and it's because I am a moonbeam, and I want you to engage with me as a moonbeam, I would say, no, that's delusional. I'm not going to join you in that. Like, that's not healthy. I'm not going to join you with that. I know this is a fine line, but so if a child says, I want you to call me by a different name, I think we need to really discuss and pray as to whether or not we should be able to say, okay, if you change your name to something else, I would be willing to do that. So at this point, I'm willing to call you by that name because I would allow you to change your name if it was something totally different. Again, I may change my views on this next week. But however, I feel like the pronoun question is asking me to join in a delusion. And I get how they may think me joining in the name is joining in the delusion. That's why I would want to tell them. Again, it's one of the advantages of if this happens in a therapeutic setting, I can say, part of my therapeutic model is not to join people in what I consider to be delusions. I define delusion as you see something in yourself that isn't real. So if you were to come in and say, I'm just trash, I'm a horrible person, I wouldn't join you there because I believe that would be delusional. You are actually this. You say you're this. I don't agree. You say you're fat when you're skinny. I don't agree. You say you're whatever. I would not go there. That's therapeutically unhealthy. You're saying you're male, though you are female. I think it's unhealthy for me to join you in that. If you disagree with my therapeutic model, you are welcome to find another therapist. But when you're a school teacher working for the public school system and a student comes in and says, my new pronoun is he, him, and my name is now Larry, that you go, okay, what do I do here? Now, I think at this point it's totally appropriate to say, it can be appropriate, not totally appropriate. It's probably within the margin of boundary, right, to call them Larry. I agree with you that you're essentially kind of joining them in that delusion and that that's weird. And you may decide differently. You may go, no. Now, I might have that conversation with them one-on-one and say, this is a name you've chosen for yourself. You could have picked any name and I would have gone with that. I'm not making a declaration about anything by calling you the name you've asked to be called. I don't know that I would ever be willing to, and no, in a therapeutic world, I would not. Now, again, how do you defer to your authority structure? If your authority structure is saying, you will call this person him, her, him, he, then I think you've got an authority question that you've got to wrestle with. You either do need to do that, or you need to remove yourself from that authority. Yeah. I really feel like that's it. Yes?
I think this is the issue. Like,
yeah.
Because I work for a global public corporation.
Right. Yeah.
And Christians are going to be looking around going, we are now separating ourselves from, they're going to be forced to resign, basically.
Right.
That's what I think is going to happen.
Yes.
And so they're going to be separating themselves from employment, separating themselves from the world.
Right.
In that sense. And so I think that's the end game. Personally, 15 years ago, we were arguing about gay marriage.
Right.
5 years ago, we were arguing about transgender bathrooms.
Right.
Now we're here.
Right.
And it's clear where this is going. And
right.
Anybody who works for a Fortune 500 public
right.
company knows that these diversity and inclusion initiatives are all going to include this, where you're going to have your pronouns in your email signature.
Right.
You're going to be forced to call these people
right.
these pronouns. So I think that's where it's going, and I don't see that changing.
I think that's, and that is where we... As I think that's where we come. Interesting enough, it's weirdly like more as loving people as general and less as Christian in some ways. So I don't know that it is necessarily unchristian to that if you met someone and you didn't know what they were and they were fooling you with their gender preference and they just told you to call me this and you did, you wouldn't somehow be sinning to ignorantly to go someone who was born a male. I think was it swimsuit issue recently that they had a male on the cover of the swimsuit issue, that the model on the cover of the sports, one of the models was a male. but was feminine enough to be in this Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue, right? And I guarantee you, if you had just opened up and looked, you wouldn't have gone like, that may be a guy. Like, nope, this was clearly female and clearly presented as female in every way possible. That's the question is, I don't think you're immoral to assume, well, that's a female, or to call, say her or whatever. I think where we run into it is when we're being demanded to join someone in a delusion and we go, I'm not convinced this is loving and I'm required to love you. Now, I do think that if there will be Christians who say, listen, the authority is requiring this of me. I'm under this authority. The Bible says to respect the authority unless it makes me sin. And I don't know if even in Christianity we've landed on whether or not that's sin or not. I know I haven't. I have not at the personal level landed. Is it sin? Because it's not, in other words, I mean, I've teased friends according to the wrong gender. Like, okay, girls, I've done that as a student minister, walked into the guy's room and gone like, all right, girls, you're supposed to be there at 9. Was I sinning at that point? Well, maybe. But so this is a question we're all wrestling with. So don't make sure you're engaging with this with lots of grace. If friends make a different decision than you do, understand we're all trying to figure out what is the correct application here. Mine is, I'm not comfortable, and in some ways this is almost more as a therapist than as a pastor. I'm not comfortable joining people in a delusion to encourage it. And so either I have to have that conversation and then say this is why I won't, but you're right, you may be in a company. And if it's not this, if you're able to go along with this, there'll be something else. Eventually the lines, I agree with you, eventually the line will move enough to where we go, okay, I can't do that. I can no longer do that. In this case, you'll have to decide to remove yourself from the authority. And either by then, we will have an entirely bifurcated culture where you have those who are on this side of the aisle and those who are on this side of the aisle. And everyone who's over here has one view and everyone who's over here has the other. We will have conservatively minded credit cards, movie companies, and everything else. And you'll never go to the other one. You know, and that's where we're moving towards. We'll either get there in time, where when this group cancels you, you just go work over here for the mirror company that does the exact same thing, it just does it with this mindset. And that's what we're getting. Schools are there. I mean, we're there with schools. So that's part of the process, and that's a sad. It's not how it was intended to be. And hopefully the church is trying to bring stuff together fast enough to go like, oh, shoot, we've got multiple cultures in the church that were a huge mistake. We learned this the hard way. We learned what happens when you develop two different cultures. And the church is now going to be spending the next 100 years trying to bring cultures back together within the church. The culture, our main culture is doing the opposite. They're going like, no, this will be great. We'll have two totally different cultures. And anyway, it's not healthy. I don't know the answer. Like, there's not a, like, let's look at this Bible passage. What I would tell you is the goal is to love the other person in truth. I will comment. I don't, those of you who know me well, so both Chris Sherrod and Beckett were using a word yesterday that is one of those trigger words for me, and it's the word balance. I don't like the word balance when we talk about Christian ethics at all. I mean, we're over, 10 minutes over. If you need to bail, go ahead. But I'll wrap up here and then pray. But I don't believe in it. I don't think balance is appropriate in Christian ethics. It isn't when the line that Beckett at some point said was, and I've loved everything they've taught, by the way, so I'm not being negative. It's just a word. This is me, not them. It's the word balance. It's to say, when at one point when Beckett said, so at that point he needed less grace, he needed more truth. That's the problem with the word balance, is it implies that these two things are in opposition to one another. They are not. He did not need less grace. He needed all the grace you can get and all the truth he can get. Those two things aren't opposite to one another. That's why you'll never hear me use the word balance from stage. There's like five of those. Hall and Crow would tell you all of them. They're little mini sermons that the kids get all the time. But the this little, to go, okay, this is one of those. I think what we're doing is going, how do I crank up the truth and crank up the love and crank up the grace simultaneously? And part of that sometimes is just a conversation. It's just going, I don't know what I'm doing. Here's the line I'm drawing. If this is wrong, I'm so sorry. I'm just doing my best here. I don't know what to do with this. No one does. No one does. And so it may be that you just have to start with the child or the friend or the neighbor or whatever to go, will you be willing to have a little grace with me? Because it's what I'm doing with Stephen Young, the African-American pastor. When we get together once a month going, I don't know what I'm doing with this. And you don't either. We have two different cultures. How that happened? Sin. How are we going to fix it? I have no idea. How do we bring these cultures back together? I guess it starts with you and me having lunch every month or so. And going, please have grace with me when I ask a white boy question. And he'll say, like, that was a white boy question. Like, okay. When he goes, how did your whole church, I mean, your whole church, I can't believe you have a whole church full of Christians who just love Trump. And I was like, okay, let me explain. Let me explain. He's like, oh, really? Not all of them? Like, no. So anyway, that is a, those are conversations that we've got to, and so I think that's part of it. I would love to encourage that. All right, let me pray. Father, we are wandering around with this. We're a little bit like the blind following the blind. And Lord, I confess my blindness in this. There's not a Bible passage that tells me whether or not I should be willing to change pronouns for someone who asks me to, much less who requires me to. At this point, this isn't a preference, it's a demand. And I don't know where I'm supposed to handle all of that and how I'm supposed to do it. And so, Lord, I pray in your grace, I know you forgive and have forgiven everywhere where I missed the mark. From the time of the cross and probably from the before the creation of time, you had forgiven all my mistakes with that. And so, Lord, I so appreciate the grace that comes with having been forgiven of mistakes I've not even made yet. Lord, I pray you would guide us in the moment to know what the right thing to do, to be humble enough to speak the truth in love, even when it means admitting we don't know what we're doing, that we can have these conversations, and sometimes just person to person, and to show the dignity of that a person, no matter how confused they are, that we recognize that they are created in your image, and we can treat them with the dignity of being honest and open and humble with them, that we're still trying to figure this out too. So Lord, I pray that you will guide us in exactly how to do this, especially with those who we love the most. God, I pray for those who of our family and our friends from our culture who are lost, who are confused, who are not sure whether or not they're willing to submit to you, Lord, or who have decided not to. I pray that you would claim their hearts, that you would recapture them in ways that maybe they've not known for a long time. Lord, you are going to have, as Beckett has shown us, it's going to have to be like a road to Damascus type of situation, apparently, for many people who have wandered so far off. And he was willing to give it all up for you. And I pray that that would be true of all of us, that whatever it is you call us to do, we'd be willing to do no matter how much we don't want to. Because that's part of what it means to follow you. And I pray this in your son's magnificent name. Amen. All righty. I think we're back at like 7 tonight. Whatever time it is on the board, trust